So good evening, everyone. Welcome to our class tonight, Vayeshev Miketz 5775. I dreamed a dream in time gone by, the creation of a nightmare reality, and I want to dedicate this class, the merit of this learning, to my late aunt, Frieda Rich, Freda Bas Reb David Velvel. So I'd like to take the opportunity this evening to explore the Torah, the Bible's view of dreams. Significance of dreams, or perhaps the insignificance of dreams. So I think we should start with the first dream in the Bible that became very, very famous. Because up to the point of Jacob dreaming with the angels going up and down the ladder, not a lot of dreaming. A lot of other things happen in the Torah, yes, but chalamot, dreams, are not part of the reality or the non-reality of the Bible's world until Jacob comes along. And then you'll notice that once that Jacob starts dreaming, everybody starts dreaming, right? Because you have Jacob's dream, and you have Joseph's dreams. You have the butler and the baker's dreams, right? Then you have Pharaoh's dreams. Everybody's dreaming. It's interesting that up until that point, we have bereft of dreams, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's like someone turns on the faucet and dreams proliferate. Okay, let's analyze that first dream. So in source number one at the bottom of the page, it says, and then Yaakov dreamed, and behold, he saw the ladder going up and down, okay? And I don't have to go through the whole quote. It's a very famous story where God says to Jacob in his dream, I'm with you. Do not worry. I know you're going to exile to your evil uncle Laban's house, and it's going to be tough for you there for 20 years, but I promise you I'll bring you back home. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that when Jacob wakes up, the end of the quote, he says, Jacob uttered a vow, saying, if God will be with me and he will guard me on the way upon which I am going, and he, God, will give me bread to eat and a garment to wear, and if I return to in peace to my father's house, and the Lord will be my God, then this stone, which I have placed as a monument, as a matseva, shall be a house of God, Beit El, and everything that you give me, I will give Meiser. I will tithe for you. Now, what's interesting is that second little quote is when Jacob wakes up. But in the dream, he was told, this is your land. Everything's great. I'm with you. So why does Jacob have to wake up and then say, oh, by the way, God, if you will be with me, then let's be partners? Unless...
make sure it wasn't just a dream?
Perhaps, right, on one level, absolutely. Or perhaps he just didn't put a lot of credibility in the dream. You know, it was one thing to have a dream, it's great, but I want to hear it in the light of day. Promise. Will I make it back alive? Yes or no? And if you say yes, I'm in. So it seems at this point that Jacob, even though it's a marvelous dream, angels up and down, and he sees all the future exiles, we are told, great, but I want something that I can bank on, you know? I can't bank on this. It's a dream. What does that mean to me? Okay, maybe this is a common thread. Let's go to source two, please. So now we get to the dreams of Joseph. Joseph dreams two different dreams. Dream one, and I'm not going to go through all of source two, but it's for your own homework later on if you choose. But of course, he dreams famously of dreams about his brothers, and the second dream, his brothers, his father, and even perhaps his late mother, although that's stretching the lines of credulity at that point. And the first dream...
about people who have passed away.
Sure, but I'll explain. The point that Jacob took exception to is that in the dream, mom's alive and bows down to him.
Yeah, but when you're dreaming...
anything's possible, right?
You've dreamt about people who have passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And in the dream, you don't realize that they're
correct,
dead.
Correct. But here... No, absolutely. The dream is as real as the waking moment. You're right, absolutely. When you wake up, it's very hard to sometimes, and we reluctantly divest ourselves from the dream. We say, oh my gosh, that was so wonderful. I wish, halavai, that could be so, right? But here's more to the point. We're going to see in a moment that this is meant as a prophetic dream, which is another animal altogether. So if it's a prophetic dream of future greatness for Joseph, that he's going to rise to great heights as a king, as a power broker, how in the world is his mother Rachel ever going to fulfill the prophecy? That's the question, right? Bruce, you're making a great point. And we're going to come back to that later on. Thank you. So in his dream, famously, he sees the stalks of wheat you know, bowing before him, bowing down before him. I remember I laughed because people used to say stalks of corn. Very often you see corn and you point out to them, you put up your hands, excuse me, but wasn't corn discovered by the Native Americans in America? How could the Torah be talked? So, okay, fine, the mistranslation, but it's very cute. Very often some of the Bibles, you know, in English will translate as corn. It's a little bit of a problem we have in Houston, you know, with that take on it. So we call it wheat. The stalks of grain, wheat, were bowing down to him. Brothers only. Second dream, star, brothers. Sun, dad. Moon, mom. And Jacob puts a lot of credibility in a dream, because Jacob thinks to himself, oh my gosh, wait a minute. This dream is from God. Because my pet name that no one else in the world is privy to in the world of God is the Shemesh. I'm the sun. Joseph can't know that. I've never told him. It must be from God. But then Jacob's torn. He says, but wait a minute. If it's from God, what's the nonsense about his mom Rachel coming and bowing? Rachel's gone. And Rashi points out in source 3, that it was actually a reference to the adoptive mother who took the place of Rachel after her early demise at age 36, Bilhah, the trusted, loyal maidservant and half-sister of Rachel. The dream referred to Bilhah, unbeknownst to Jacob, okay? So he has these famous, famous dreams, and you see in number 3, Jacob's a little torn. He says, will we really come? Isn't your mother Rachel already dead? And then it goes on to tell us, according to Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, from a famous, famous Medrash Rabbah oral tradition, that it was really a reference to his mom. Now, listen to what line 3 of source 3 says. Our rabbis, however, derive from here that there is no dream without meaningless components. Shtuyot. Nonsensical things. And we all know ourselves, right? You think about your own experience in your dream. Part of the dream, and you know they say dreams are like a few seconds only. So part of your dream will have something like profound and powerful and maybe even disturbing. But then the other parts of the dream don't make any sense at all on any level. It could be. I mean, this is amazing, right? I'm sure you've experienced this. Somehow, all of a sudden, a car horn or an alarm will go off in the background, which is going off because your neighbor just stupidly opened the car, doesn't know how to shut off the car alarm, right? But your mind is so brilliant, it'll instantly do like a Spielberg, you know, retake and adapt the new input so the car alarm or the truck sound, right, becomes part of your dream. Have you ever, we've all experienced that, right? Like the input, visceral input will affect the dream, but your mind doesn't go, well, gee, I'm awake and this is nonsense, right? It just incorporates the new stuff into the dream, and it all, the plot just seems to become normal again, right? We wake up and then we hear the car horn in the background. We wake up. We go, oh my gosh, how did this happen? How did the car horn become part of, you know, the dream with this? And I was playing basketball for the Lakers and Kobe, right? How did the car horn, all of a sudden, you know, the car horn became part of the reality? It's brilliant. So clearly there is a subconscious play here that the dream is being affected. So the Torah even goes out of its way here and starts to tell us that every dream has basically nonsense in it. So what did Jacob think? He thought, okay, it's from God, yes. It's going to come true, sure. But the part about Rachel, nonsense. Now, does the nonsense puzzle, does it invalidate the rest? No. So Jacob was torn because on one hand, yes, it's from God. On the other hand, it can't come through on this level. So what could that mean? So the rabbis say it could be that parts are meaningless, like we've all experienced. It's hard to sort of separate, I hate to use this word, the wheat from the chaff. Okay, the dreams were about the wheat and the chaff. Okay, so it's hard to separate the reality from the non-reality, the meaningful from the meaningless. Source number 4. So the brothers did not take these dreams lightly. If you recall, these dreams became so definitive of the relationship between the brothers that the two things, what were the two things that really, really irked the brother? Anyone seen Donny Osmond's magical performance in Joseph the Technicolor Dreamcoat? You know, the famous play, right? We know that it was the Technicolor Dreamcoat, the Kusonis Pasim, and the dreams that just drove them ballistic against them, right? Because here's the little brother, 11th son, the pretty boy, the smarty guy, the smart aleck, you know, Mr. Goody Two-Shoes, always reporting back to dad about our bad behavior, what he thinks is our bad behavior. And it's bad enough that he does this, and that he's the favorite son of the one who our mom, Leah, never was loved, and Rachel was loved, right? So they had a lot of animosity built in there, a lot of sibling rivalry. But then that manifestation of Jacob's love through the special coat that he gave him, great. And then the dreams drove them nuts, so much so that when they are out in the field and he comes to them, They call him the Baal HaChalamos HaLazad Baal. They said, Hine, here comes this dreamer. Let's go kill him now. So it's clear that this is definitive of the relationship between the brothers and Joseph, right? And it's not a coincidence that the first thing they do, and Reuven is brilliant, because Reuven wants to save Joseph's life. And he realizes the brothers are ready to rip him to shreds. So he says, well, don't kill him. Just rip off that coat that you hate so much, like tear it up, you know, and throw him in the pit. Get your aggression up, but don't kill him. So he's very smart, right? He noticed the first thing they do is Vayavshitu Eschatzonis, right? They literally rip off that coat. So the coat becomes like the physical manifestation of their frustration towards this Joseph. So it's very a lot of psychology at play, which I think is hand in hand with the old nature of what dreams are, or maybe they're not. Let's see. Let's explore. Okay? So source number four. It says, and they, the brothers, saw Joseph from afar, and when he had not yet drawn near to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They felt justified that he was deserving of death. They felt that he tried to kill them, and therefore one who is a false witness and tries to condemn someone to death, he or she themselves get the death penalty. It's a fascinating law called Edim Zomamin. If someone testifies in a court of law that, you know, you did a horrific sin that merits the death penalty were it to be carried out, when it is proven that you are actually part of a tusum, what they call Edim Zomamin, these plotting witnesses, and you manufacture this. And when a second set of witnesses comes, says, wait a minute, how could you have been the witness to this crime? The night in question, you were with us in Philadelphia at the Sixers game. You claim you were at the hockey game in Pittsburgh? Come on, it's impossible, right? So the law, it's a beautiful, interesting law, really a beautiful quid pro quo, is that you get the death penalty, exact whatever that punishment is. If it's a fine, good, you paid the fine because you tried to elicit that erroneously, illegally from that person. So you get done to you what would have been done to them. Interesting, no? Very interesting law. So they felt this was Joseph. Why? Because Joseph went to dad and said, gee, I witnessed the brothers eating limb from a live animal. So even though the Torah wasn't given yet, but the seven Noah laws were given. And one of the seven Noah laws is torturing an animal. And it's capital crime. Now, had the brothers really done this? No, absolutely not. One of the possibilities that they had ritually slaughtered, they had shechted the animal, and I don't want to get graphic here, anyone who's a big meat eater, but sometimes the nervous system, you know, can react even after the veins and the jugular and the trachea and esophagus have been cut. I've seen this in my own eyes. So the cow or whatever in question could be moving, and it looks like it's still alive. For all intents and purposes, it's ritually quivering. Been slaughtered. It's dead.
Quivering.
Correct. It quivers. It has the reaction. Very well. So that's possibly what they saw. So Joseph saw this, and instead of doing what we should do, which is to go to a person and say, did I just see you do such a sin? And then the person has a right to defend themselves, or could turn red in the face and say, yeah. But that's called hocheach tochiach, to let know the person that you suspect them of something. And then, once you've confronted them with the information, you give them a chance to defend themselves at that point. You know, our society, our world would be a much greater place if people would do that. If somebody said something hurtful, or what we perceive to be hurtful, or something just not appropriate, if we wouldn't just allow it to go away and make our own little spin on it, or we see something from our own perspective that looks suspicious, what if we should go to that person and confront that person? It's actually a Torah law that you should do this, rather than going behind their back and reporting them without giving them a chance to explain themselves. Maybe they don't have a chance, but you know, you see a rabbi walking into a McDonald's on a hot summer day, you don't run around and tweet or Facebook, gee, I saw the Orthodox rabbi going to McDonald's. Maybe you go to the rabbi and say, Rabbi, I don't know how to ask you this, but you know, yesterday I was driving by, I couldn't help but notice, I saw you, I think you were walking into the McDonald's over at, on River Street, or wherever it is. And the person would say, sure, of course. I was going to use the washroom, or I was, you know, whatever, my car broke down. Oh, okay, makes sense. Or whatever the issue, at least you give the person a chance to explain the situation. Joseph did not do this.
Can I tell you a quick story?
Sure, of course.
Similar to what you just said. Can you hear me down there?
Yes.
This rabbi's walking down the street, and he sees one of his very religious congregants walking into a restaurant. He says, this doesn't sound right, because this is like a Shomer Shabbos guy, and he's going into a restaurant, and it wasn't a kosher restaurant. So he gets really curious, and he stops, and he looks through the window, and the guy goes to a table. Waiter comes over, gives him a menu. He's reading the menu. He tells the waiter what he wants. He's sitting there waiting. The waiter comes back, puts the food in front of him, and it's all treif. And just as the guy was about to put it up to his mouth, the rabbi couldn't take it anymore. He barges in. He says, stop, stop. You can't eat that. That's treif. Don't you know that? The guy says, how do you know this? He said, because I was standing outside when it all started. And you saw me go into the restaurant? Yeah. You saw me sit down? Yeah. You saw me place the order? Yeah. You saw the waiter bring the food? Yeah. Well, what's the problem, Rabbi? It's all under rabbinical supervision.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing, Mary. That's very cute. So Joseph then, in the eyes of the brothers, was deserving of the death penalty. So scene switches then to number four. So they saw him and they yelled out in the middle of number four. So they said to one another, actually it was Shimon and Levi, who said to one another, behold, hine, ba'al ha'chalamos ha'lazeh ba, here comes that dreamer. So now let us kill him, and we'll cast him into one of the pits, and we will say, a wild beast devoured him, and we will see what becomes of his dreams. Direct correlation, right? Dreams. Boom. Let's stop the dreams. Now, what's the greatest irony in the world? Well, oh my gosh, this is brilliant, right? It's delicious. They want to stop his dreams, correct? Let's look at number five. And then they say, and we will see what will become of his dreams. Rabbi Isaac says, the verse says, expound on me. In other words, this verse demands a midrashic oral interpretation because it doesn't make sense. The Holy Spirit says thus, they, the brothers, say, huh, let us kill him. But the verse concludes, and then we will see what will become of his dreams. Let us see whose word will stand up, yours or mine, God says. Because it's impossible to say that the brothers are going to say, and we will see what will become of his dreams, because since they will kill him, obviously it's a simple, obvious conclusion that if they kill him, the dreams will come to naught. So it's God's words that are finishing it. In other words, the brothers say, let's kill him, right? And then the idea that we will see what will become of his dreams was uttered by God. So what does God say to the brothers? You want to stop him? Okay, let's see how you like this. Not only are the dreams going to come to become a reality, you guys are going to be the instrument through which they become the reality. Because it's through your sale of Joseph as a slave, everything's going to come from that. He's going to become the king of the world because of your participation. Wow. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, at the end, when the brothers must have realized the futility of what they tried to effect all those years earlier, and it was because of their inability to accept Joseph and the dreams that turned around and God used them as his emissaries to effect the fulfillment of the dreams. Wow. I mean, you know, God help us if we think we can outsmart the man upstairs. Okay, let's go on. Number six. Now we get to the dreams of the cupbearer, the wine butler, and the baker of Pharaoh. Now, if you recall, both transgressed Pharaoh. They say that a pebble was found in one of the bakery items that was given to Pharaoh, so the chief baker was held accountable for the sin of the underling. And a fly decided to pay a visit to the goblet of Pharaoh just as he was about to drink it. So he was very angry, Pharaoh, had them both thrown into the royal prison. Happened to be the place where Joseph was, because Joseph was in a prison controlled by his former master, Potiphar, who ran the prison system there in Egypt. And they had different levels of prisons. They had the prisons where you did not want to go, the dungeons. And then you had like a Ritz-Carlton-style prison. You know, you had Wi-Fi and HDTV and stuff, but you were imprisoned. So that's where Joseph was for his years. In fact, I'll go farther than that. Potiphar himself knew that Joseph was innocent, because when they examined his coat that he ran away and left in the hands of Mrs. Potiphar, they simply examined it for evidence. And they said, well, which side is it ripped upon? If it's ripped in the front, very simple. She's protecting herself from his advance. But if the coat is ripped in the back, his story is true, that he ran away and she tried to pull him back and ripped off his coat. So when they examined the evidence, it's very simple. His wife was a philanderer. But yet he couldn't effect punishment of his wife because he would lose his job, his station in Egypt, would be an embarrassment to the throne. So he said to Joseph, Joseph, you know, I know you're innocent, but I'm going to have to at least publicly throw you in jail. But the Medrash goes farther. This oral tradition says that he would let Joseph out every single day to work in his house and manage the household. And then at night, he would sort of quietly bring him back to prison.
He also let him to prison.
Correct.
Which showed that he thought he was somewhat innocent.
Correct. Correct.
He didn't lead the person who...
Right. He knew his... I'm sure he knew his wife. I mean, if she tried to seduce Joseph for a year... You think he's totally oblivious to what his wife's up to? I mean, it can't be, right? I mean, he must have known who is Zulecha, that was her name, what she was up to. Okay, let's get
probably
back into...
Joseph probably wasn't the first, either.
Right, exactly. Just the most handsome. Exactly, good point. Good point. So, number six. Now, both of them, meaning the butler and the baker, dreamed a dream, each one his dream on the same night, each man according to the interpretation of his dream, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison. Now, why does it have to say, now both of them dreamed a dream? It's redundant. Why not just say, they both dreamed a dream? Now, both of them dreamed a dream. It seems like superfluous. Vayachalmu chalom shneihem. So the rabbis say, why does it have to have that repetition? Vayachalmu, they dreamed, chalom, a dream, shneihem, the both of them. It could wipe out the word chalom in the middle and just say, they both dreamed. So why the extra word? Because they actually had two dreams. To paraphrase here, each dreamed his own dream, but without the interpretation. He dreamed the other guy's interpretation. So the baker knew what was in store for the butler, and the butler knew, sadly, for the baker, what was in store for the baker. But neither of them confided in each other. So when they get up the next morning and Joseph comes and they're disturbed, each is disturbed because they don't know their own interpretation, but the baker must have said, oh my gosh, birds eating, not a good thing to have in a dream, but he was resentful that he knew the butler was going to get his old job back and everything was going to turn out okay. But he must have been discombobulated by his own dream because he must have felt, oh my gosh, it's not good having birds rip food in a dream. It's probably not a nice thing. Now the butler, who had a good dream, right, with the grapes and the goblet, but he knew that the end for his baker pal was going to be death. So he must have said, oh my gosh, it seems like it's okay for me, but if he's going to get killed, maybe I'm the same thing. Pharaoh's not going to be merciful to me either, right? So neither one wanted to talk to the other guy, and Joseph, of course, interprets their dreams famously for them. Now, what was important about them understanding the other guy's interpretation? Because it validated Joseph's interpretation. In other words, what? If the butler already knows what the baker's dream means, and the baker knows what the butler's dream means, and in fact, it says that after the baker saw that Joseph interpreted it correctly, then he tells him his dream. Well, how does the baker know that he interpreted it correctly? Now we know, because he knew the interpretation already. Joseph simply validated it. In fact, the same thing is true by Pharaoh. You want to hear inside information? Pharaoh knew the interpretation of the dreams of the cows and the wheat. But God snapped his fingers, I guess, metaphorically, as he woke, and it was sort of on the periphery of his memory. You know how, like, you're trying to get that elusive name or a basketball player's stat or something, it's just like, and as soon as you desist from your mental hard drive trying to access that information, you know how the number, the name, whatever, always pops into your head as you're walking out the door? So he made it that Pharaoh would know the information, but it was elusive to him. It wasn't in his conscious mind. But when he would hear the correct interpretation from any of his interpreters, it would all click into place. So he had hundreds of people come and say, your seven cows mean this, and the seven wheat mean this, right? And he said, no, that's not it. Bye, next, next, next. But when Joseph comes, kaboom, clicks into place. Otherwise, how would in advance of the 7 years of feast and famine, how would Pharaoh have known instantaneously that Joseph was the one? If he didn't click for him. So it's kind of an interesting little side point. Okay, let's go on.
But the same dreams about the same thing.
Oh, okay, yes, yes. So you're pointing out that the subject matter,
yes, the
right.
The subject matter was, that's what the dreams.
Right.
The dreams. Each one, they didn't dream one, the other was, one dreamed about animals,
right,
and then about wine.
Right,
and
right.
This way, they dreamt about food because that had to do with the whole...
Right. Very good. I like that, Kivar. I like that very much. So please turn the page number 8. So let's just stop for a second and let's just recap, do a quick little review, okay? So we're saying like this. It's not clear the whole idea of dreams. Jacob dreams, ladder, angels, yes. Does he put a lot of stock in it? Not, apparently not, right? Because the next day he has to make a promise out loud, that if God's with me, good, if not, not. Okay, that's the beginning. Then we get to the dreams, of course, of Joseph. Jacob at that point, once again, he's torn. Because part of the dream seems it's all from God, because he calls him his pet name, son. He's metaphorically the son in Joseph's second dream. But Rachel's not around, so he's like, I don't know. Is this true? Not true? It's not clear. The brothers define Joseph on the dreams. They take the rage out. Let's see what's going to happen. Of course, God has other plans in store. So let's carry on now. So the butler and the baker have their dreams. Exactly what Joseph told them comes true. But the butler forgets about Joseph for 2 years to the day. It's Pharaoh's birthday. Great trivia question, which Jason Cohen mentioned was on Jeopardy last Thursday evening. Seriously, Alex Trebek asked, you know, something about who's the only birthday mentioned in the Bible, in the Old Testament. It's Pharaoh. So it's a great trivia question. So it's the birthday of Pharaoh, and he's reading off, you know, the list of his beloved servants of yesteryear. He hasn't seen these guys for a year. They've been in the dungeon, right? Where is that butler and baker? He hasn't carried sentence. He was so angry. He just kind of said, get him out of sight. I don't want to see them. He didn't sentence them to death. So now he goes over the facts. Let's see. Fly has its own movement. It chose to come into my cup. That's not negligence. That's just bad luck. Butler, come on back, pal. I miss you. You were really good with the cup. Baker? Oh, come on, man. You could have done a better job sifting the flour. I'd have to break my teeth on some pebble. That was negligent. Off with his head. And that's exactly what happened, right? So he brings back the butler. The butler doesn't remember Joseph that day. And for two long years, every time he's in the presence of Pharaoh, he's like, gee, doggone it. What is it? There was something I wanted to say. I had a promise. And every day as he leaves the palace and he can't come back in until the next day, you know, his little security car, bang, you know, he leaves the palace. Boom. Oh, my gosh, again. How dumb of me. I couldn't remember. For 2 years, this goes on. Finally, Pharaoh has his dreams. He wakes up the next day and he's shaken. Now, I won't go into that. It's not the proper form that we're not going into that. But the dreams with the Nile River, which is their god, their life source of Egypt, shook him to the core. He's got to know fat cows, I mean, skinny cows, naked, gross looking cows, which could only live in a dream, you know, like gross zombie cows eating the fat cows and the wheat. You know, it's horrific. So he's desperate. So next morning he calls in everybody, you know, $1 million. Anyone interprets his dreams. Everyone has their interpretations. Nothing's going on. And then finally, kaboom, like a light, the butler remembers Joseph and his dreams. So obviously he's not in it to help Joseph, because it's very clear from the text that he doesn't like Jews. And he belittles Joseph in front of him. He calls him a slave and a young kid and a Jew. You know, we don't like those Jews. Even back then there was some anti-Semitism. Those Hebrews, you know, coming from across the river. So he belittles them because he must sense that this kid, Joseph, is something special. So he tries to put him down, even as he's like trying to use Joseph's abilities for his own improvement in station in life. So he tells them about Joseph. Maybe he can help. Let's get Joe. So Joseph comes out of the dungeon, takes a haircut, shave, you know, nice new clothes.
Right away.
Boom, comes right in. It says, Vayiritsu minabor.
Right away, and never was no time.
Exactly. And in fact, they say that when the redemption will come, it's going to come like with Joseph. And it was when the Messiah, when Mashiach is going to be here, the airplane for Jerusalem leaves now. Get your boarding passes, ladies and gentlemen. You know, it's not going to be any hesitation. Boom, from the outhouse to the penthouse, it's going to be in 1 day or less, okay? Let's get on board. So, Joseph's brought in front of Pharaoh, and he famously says, look, it's not me, it's God. And then here's the dreams. He says, number one thing, Pharaoh, the two dreams, they're just one dream. Same dream, but they're repeated. Because God's anxious to make this come into effect. It's going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to wait. Oh my gosh. So right away, Pharaoh's impressed. And then he explains to him the nature of the dreams, a famous, famous story. Okay? Now, what is beautiful about this, let's look at number 8. You can read this again later on, but not today. Not at this moment. The cupbearer recounts his own experience with Joseph from 2 years earlier, right? And in it, He tells Pharaoh all about what happened 2 years ago. Because what is Pharaoh going to remember the details from 2 years ago about a cupbearer and a baker? Maybe to the baker and the cupbearer was an important incident in their lives. It changed their lives, not in a nice way, right? But to the Pharaoh, come on, I just dispose of people every couple seconds. So the cupbearer has to go over the whole sordid history of the past, right? And in it, listen to what he says. I call to my mind my faults today. You see, it's about six lines from the bottom of the source number 8. He says, Eschata'ai ani maskir hayom. I remember my sins today. He's embarrassed. He says, Pharaoh was angry with his servants. He put me in prison in the house of the chief slaughterer, means Potiphar, me and the chief baker. And we dreamed a dream on the same night, I and he, each one according to the interpretation of his dream we dreamed. And there with us was a Hebrew lad, Jew, a slave, of the chief of the slaughterer. And we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. For each of us, he interpreted according to his dream. And guess what? And it came to pass that just as he has interpreted, so it was. Me, meaning the cupbearer, he, Pharaoh, meaning you, he's talking to him in third person, restored to my position as cupbearer to the royal family. But him, baker, I like when these pronouns, he hanged. Now, what do you notice here? If you look very carefully, he said, and it came to pass, the last line, that just as he had interpreted, so it was. Kasher pasar lanu kein haya. As he interpreted for us, so came about the reality. Now that might be a very important thing. I would offer to you tonight that the interpretation of said dream defines the reality of what is going to be with the dream. Positive, negative, or otherwise. Now, how are we going to see this? Let's go on to number 9 very quickly. Now, Joseph was the ruler over the land. So this is now years after the hunger. The hunger has began only in the first year and two. The 7 years have come and gone of plenty. He stored up all the granaries and everything. And it was Joseph who sold grain to everyone, okay? And Joseph's brothers, line 2, number 9, came. The brothers of Joseph came, 10 of them. And they prostrated themselves to the ground. So it's almost the fulfillment of dream 1 because we're missing Benjamin. There were 11 in the original dream. So 10 of them now are bowing down with their faces to the ground. And Joseph saw his brothers and he recognized them, but he made himself a stranger to them and he spoke to them harshly and he said to them, where do you come from? And they said, well, from the land of Canaan to purchase food. Now Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And this is the crucial statement. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed about them. And he said to them, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land. And we know the story from there on, right? That he treats them as if they are spies and he has all these tests for them. We'll speak about that, God willing, in 2 weeks from tonight. Let's go back. Let's go back to the original dreams of Joseph. I want you to hear something that you probably missed, because I missed it. I only heard it from my Rebbe, my Rosh Hashanah. When Joseph says the dreams for his brothers and then for his brothers and his father, he says, you know, I dreamed a dream and I'm really excited. Let me tell you in this dream, right, that the 11 stalks of wheat are bowing down and then the star, the sun, the moon bowing down. Does Joseph offer ever an interpretation to those dreams? No. Who interpreted the dreams?
The brothers.
The brothers. They were really angry. You're going to rule over us? You, Joseph, are going to be the king? You're going to lord it over us? Ah. He never interpreted the dreams. They did. The interpretation affected the reality of what the dreams would mean. Joseph never once said, I'm going to be the king and I'm going to be some maniacal ruler who's going to, you know, put your faces in the dirt and treat you like garbage and get back at you for all the victimization of my youth. That's not the reality. They put the reality stamp on it by interpreting it this way. So when Joseph's thinking back, he says, oh my gosh, I know the dreams now, but the dreams are coming the way they're coming, not because of what I did. I just simply transmitted information from God. I said, here guys, here Abba, this is what I was told by God. They said, oh, and they interpreted it for him, right? And of course, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yes?
Did Yeah, but only because they were mad doesn't mean that they didn't interpret it correctly.
Correct. No, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
All they did was interpret it correctly. That they were upset about it was another issue.
Right, right. Well, okay, excellent. Philip is making a great point. But let me ask you. I'm not disagreeing here. Let's suppose, and this, I think this is what you're saying, that he was in fact being told that he would become the supreme ruler. True. But was there any negativity attached to that at that point? Not necessarily, right? In other words, he later will say to the brothers, many, many parshas later, unfortunately, have to wait, you know, suspenseful. He says, look, guys, ultimately, don't blame yourselves, because it was God. He was pulling the strings all along. Mm-hmm. I was brought here for one specific purpose, to be here, to settle the land, to have food. Va'ani achakel. I will be the provider for you during the days of famine and darkness. I was God's plan. Let me ask you a question. While I agree 100% with what you're saying, it's very good, it's very smart. In other words, Philip is saying that the reality is that Joseph's going to become the ruler. But the brothers perceived it as a negative when it didn't have to be a negative. Abraham is told, you Jews are going to live in Egypt, a land foreign to you. You'll be strangers in a strange land, right? Geri yelechem be'eretz lo'lohem. We say it on Passover in the Haggadah. Great. How was the mechanical way that they were going to be brought to Egypt? How was that going to take effect? Well, that was open. So all Joseph was being shown is that he's going to be the ruler. Great. But why did it have to be a negative experience? Why couldn't the brothers have said, okay, Joseph's going to be the ruler. It doesn't mean he's going to lord it over you and smash your faces in the dirt. He's your brother. He loves you. Okay, you have disagreements. Be happy that a Jew's going to be running Egypt. No. The brothers saw it in the most horrific, nightmarish way, that if Joseph, this egomaniacal, maniac little kid, if he's going to run any country, it's obviously going to be at our cost. So they only saw it in a negative. The trip to Egypt could have been benign. It could have been a nice trip. They all could have come down as a family, been established there in the land of Goshen like it was. There didn't have to be all this resentment and infighting and backstabbing and tests and back and forth. God didn't say, Abraham, your children are going to go to land to Egypt. Great. By the way, I'm going to bring them down there in a crazy way. One's going to go first as a slave and he's going to be in jail and then test. No, that wasn't part of the plan. Who made that part of the reality? The brothers defined their own reality. That's why I'm calling the class. The nightmare was affected by the brothers' interpretation. It was never Joseph. Now, if you think it's a small issue, look at what the cupbearer says to Pharaoh. The way he interpreted the dreams for us, that's what it was. He's saying to Pharaoh, it's not just that he explained the dreams. He made them become a reality for us. This is how it is. Now, if you think this is a small issue, look at mind-bending number 10 and 11. This is mind-bending to me. Number 10, I love this one, okay? Remember Lucy and Peanuts used to have, you know, the doctor is in. So you can picture Jerusalem, apparently, they had 24 little booths set up with Madame Zushkas from all over Eastern Europe, the heavyset lady with the crystal ball and the shemata on her head, you know. And you come, pay 5 cents, 5 shekel, and you get your interpretation, right? So listen to this. There were 24 dream interpreters in Jerusalem, the Talmud says in Barachot. I, Rabbi Benah, once dreamed a dream, and it bothered. This poor rabbi was going nuts. I got to understand, what is my dream about? So he went, and he put in 5 shekels and all the pushkas of the 24 dream interpreters in Jerusalem. And every single one gave me a different interpretation, the rabbi says. Not one was the same. And you know what? And they all came true. Every single one of the 24 interpretations. They all came to be. As they say, kol chalamot achar hapeh. All dreams follow the mouth, the interpreter of the dream. How do we know that all dreams follow the mouth? Gee, where do you think he sources it in the Talmud? From what it says, the way that Yosef interpreted it was exactly the way it worked out. Our Parsha. This is the source for the Talmud's famous saying that dreams follow the interpreter, not the dream. Oh my gosh. And now my favorite of all, look at number 11. This is the best. Caesar once challenged Rabbi Shua ben Hananiah, famous Tana, sage in the Talmud, okay? Caesar is not a friendly Caesar to the Jews. This one's really despicable. He says, look, you Jews are special. He says, you Jews claim to be very wise. Tell me what I will see in my dreams. No, don't tell me what my dreams mean? Tell me what I am going to dream tonight. Now, oh, come in. I mean, come on. We're many things, but this is we're not. So listen to the brilliance of the rabbi. He's so brilliant. He says, okay. You will see yourself captured by Persians. At that moment, the Persians were really giving Rome a hard time. You're inflicting a lot of damage in Eastern battles. So he knew, the rabbi did, because according to CNN, the Canal News Network, there was a big problem with the Persian insurrection. So he knew the Caesar would be weighing on him, right? So he says, I see that you, Caesar, are going to be actually physically captured by the Persian army, who will set you to grinding date stones, and you're going to be a shepherd of rodents, and you're going to have a golden staff in your hand. Caesar thought about it all day. And sure enough, at night he dreamed it. Of course, well, what else could it be, right? It's such a vivid imagery, the big rats, you know, and the golden staff and the Persians. So poor Caesar's all day going, oh my gosh, what does this mean, right? So of course he dreamed it at night. All right, it's the end of the class. What's the takeaway? So let me share something with you that I would take away, but please, I would like to hear what you have to offer. The Torah is not saying that dreams are meaningless. Obviously, Joseph's dreams were singularly a prophetic vision from God, even though we are told that there are parts that don't have to be quite make sense at that point, right? There are devarim that are shtuyot, that are, you know, a little bit off. Okay, fine. But clearly, what are dreams about? Dreams are something that we communicate with ourselves. Generally, we're probably speaking to ourselves. It's our subconscious processing information, what we could be, how we see our lives, how we see ourselves, trying to process who we are, where we are, and who we hope to be. That's how we use it every day in our lives. You know, what do you dream? The dreamer, what do you imagine for this, right? It's what we want to be. It's how we envision our identity, our self, for who we hope to be. So there's no question that we can limit ourselves tragically by imposing a self-fulfilling prophecy to the ultimate extreme in negativity, and it could just destroy ourselves like it did with the brothers. Because here was a dream that they were given from Joseph. I understand that they didn't like the messenger of the dream at all. He was very distasteful to the brothers. But instead of approaching it like, gee, he's going to be the king, they could have said, gee, he's going to be the king, and you know, we're going to need Joe there to take care of us because there's going to be a serious situation with a world famine, with a drought. No, it was negative, right? So it became negative. And you see from all the different quotes that every time someone has something that's open-ended and they define it, the definition becomes the reality. And so the self-fulfilling prophecy was, I dreamed a dream in time gone by, but why did life kill the dream I dreamed? I'm quoting from Les Mis. Why did life kill the dream I dreamed? Because I allowed it to be killed through my own experience, my negativity. I quashed my own dream. That's the tragedy. And so I think the takeaway is that we should dream. We should continue to dream for ourselves, for the Jewish people. We really need it. And those dreamers are the ones who effect change, you know. Those are the ones who dreamed about a little place, you know, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River that became Israel. No one could think it could be really. It took dreams. It took imagination. And I think that sadly we so often in our lives limit the blessing that could be in our life. God says it's open-ended. How do you see it? Here, I'll give you a little hint what could be. But what do you think? What do you see? And we look with this prism of negativity, like the brothers did, and it just sucks the reality of the bracha, the blessing that's waiting for us. It just kills it. And it becomes, unfortunately, a reality of a nightmare or a self-fulfilling prophecy that's just the opposite of what we want. So it should be our zchut, our merit should be like Joseph the dreamer, who never gave up. I mean, from day one to the end, he was always Joseph the righteous for 110 years. Amazing. No matter what he was subjected to a woman, to an insane woman who changed her clothing in the most seductive way, multiple times every day, trying to seduce a 17-year-old boy in a foreign land who had no context to his life. And he's able to withstand that? Really? That's how he becomes Joseph the Righteous. To brothers who literally were going to throw him in a pit and rip him to shreds, and he overcomes all of that, and never at one point do you see Joseph giving up. I mean, the only moment where there's a hiccup is when he maybe relies on the cupbearer to mention him to Pharaoh, right? It's the only negative blight on his whole, you know, God forbid, you know, that should be the worst thing, you know?
He had to wait 2 years.
Right, he had to wait 2 years because he's Joseph, because very clearly as he gets out of jail at that time, it's the wrong time. He needed to wait when Pharaoh needed his dreams. Pharaoh needed him. I mean, what if Pharaoh had brought him out 2 years earlier? Mm-hmm. He would have become a paid member of Pharaoh's staff, interpreter.
Maybe that's why he had to wait 2 years.
Exactly.
Because he waited.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And
because think about the dynamic, right? If he's on the roster as a paid dream interpreter already, Pharaoh says, Joseph, you know, intercom, had some very disturbing dreams about the cows, and then can you send Joseph, the dream interpreter, in? He comes in, he says, yes, Pharaoh. He says, look, I pay you big bucks. Can you help me out here with the dreams? And he says, yes, Pharaoh, the dreams, you right? He's, oh, that's brilliant, great. Okay, double Joseph's salary, gentlemen, let's, right? Well, Joseph doesn't get the job as Pharaoh. He doesn't become the king of the world. The whole dynamic is different if he gets out 2 years earlier. Now, this is all unbeknownst to Joseph, who's languishing in jail, so it doesn't really help him that much, okay? But the takeaway, I think, is very profound. We should all continue to have dreams, dream those dreams, and to always just be unlimited, just have limitless dreams that we should be realized in our days quickly and soon.
We have to get the dreams, but we have to interpret them
in a positive way, what could be, with that prism of positivity. Thank you, everyone. Shabbat shalom.